Today at Reader's Corner, John Gertner, author of The Idea Factory, Bell Labs, and the Great Age of American Innovation.
By the 1920s, when AT&T's monopoly was pretty much secure, they created Bell Labs to do research and development about anything relating to human communications. They had this kind of never-ending stream of problems, and that's a pretty good catalyst for finding good solutions. They really were trying to solve practical problems. The goal of Bell Labs was to bring an idea all the way through its process, taking a breakthrough, nurturing it, keeping with it, and then finally bringing it to fruition through manufacturing.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In many respects, innovation is the buzzword of the 21st century. Corporations, research institutions, and entrepreneurs tout its value as they seek to generate new knowledge, products, and services. But where does innovation come from, and how can we make it integral to our organizations? Today's guest, John Gertner, offers some fascinating insights into those questions in his new book, The Idea Factory, Bell Labs and the Great Age of American Innovation. In its heyday, Bell Labs was the largest and arguably the best laboratory in the world. The Idea Factory provides a detailed and fascinating history of Bell Labs, the brilliant scientists who worked there, and their contributions. In doing so, Mr. Gertner provides a window on a highly successful organization that greatly advanced modern technologies and pioneered workplace practices that remain relevant and instructive today. Mr. Gertner has been a writer for the New York Times Magazine since 2004 and is currently an editor at Fast Company Magazine. He joins us by phone from New York City. John Gertner, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, John, I was thinking about our students here at Boise State who are all, well, not all, the majority of them anyway, are somewhere in between the ages of 18 and 24, which means they have no idea what living was like under the AT&T monopoly, which, of course, in 1984 was blown up by Judge Green's decision, and they had to divest. Can you help us from the beginning? What role does the AT&T monopoly play in Bell Labs, and how does it get going as a result?
Sure. First we have to imagine that AT&T was a very different company than the AT&T we have today. And it's a long, complicated story of how that company evolved. But this was a different company, and it was a predecessor. And essentially, AT&T's role was to furnish telephone service for about 80 to 90% of the people and businesses in the United States. And they were effectively granted this monopoly by the United States government, which allowed them to do this. So AT&T was really just a colossus as a company. In an era before Google and Microsoft, I mean, this was a far, far, far larger organization. It controlled all the long-distance coverage in the United States. It controlled a manufacturing company called Western Electric that made all the telephone equipment, and it controlled parts of these local telephone companies around the country, you know, Pacific Bell, New York Telephone, and the like. Now, what it also did was it controlled a laboratory, what eventually became kind of understood to be the world's greatest laboratory. So by about the 1920s, when AT&T's monopoly was pretty much secure, they created this standalone laboratory called Bell Telephone Laboratories, otherwise known as Bell Labs, and they funded it. And Bell Labs' role in the business of telephone service, as well as, I guess you could say, the business of the country, was to do research and development about anything relating to human communications. So they worked on making the telephone system in the United States better and better, but they also had this extra capacity to do deep research. And one of the reasons they could do that is they had a tremendous stream of funding from the phone company. It was a monopoly with tremendous revenue, so it could really fund this laboratory in a way that was not necessarily indulgent, but could hire the best people, could hire lots of them, and could support projects for decades, really, you know, long-term projects that might not pay off in the short term. And really, Bell Labs' great, I guess, golden age It started in the mid-20s, but it really took off right after World War II. And from 1945 till really its demise in the 1980s, it was really an A to Z innovation shop. It could do anything from the basic scientific advances to really creating the platform innovations on which all our communications products today are really based.
Well, we take the telephone for granted today, but give us an example of a few of the challenges that the company faced, first starting, I guess, just with the increased number of phone calls, but then all of the technology that really, again, we take for granted, but in picking up the phone and setting it down, Bell Labs had to figure out a lot of how you do that.
That's right. If you go back to those very early days at the beginning of the 1900s, you know, there were no dial tones, there were no busy signals. The switching, you know, it took a long time to connect a call, and oftentimes it wasn't automated at all. You needed operators. And most fundamentally, it was actually in the early part of the century difficult to get a phone call across the country. One of the things that changed that was something called the vacuum tube, which allowed telephone calls to be amplified and pushed farther and farther distances. And Bell Labs and AT&T were instrumental in that technology, and it opened up this whole world of electronic advances. Now, what it also did for Bell Labs was when you have a kind of solution, you kind of keep looking for ways to make it better. And one of the things that these vacuum tubes, these amplifiers, did was that they were kind of problematic. They burned out a lot. They were kind of expensive. They were hot. They were sort of large. And one of Bell Labs' great advances, really what led to one of the great inventions, I think, of the 20th century, was some of these shortcomings in vacuum tubes led to the invention of the transistor at Bell Labs, which occurred in 1947 and really paved the way for this era of electronic miniaturization, our cell phones, all these integrated circuits, these millions of transistors on a chip that power our cell phones and laptops. But that's, again, just one example. So there were these great leaps at the beginning of just trying to actually make a phone system work and connect callers. But then as the traffic increased, as you said, and as the needs of the system just kept growing and growing, some of the solutions became more and more complex. And out of that came things like transistors, came things like lasers, and other things such as digital communications, which allowed, you know, vast numbers of phone calls and communications exchanges to be with fewer errors and with greater capacity.
Did they also put the first satellite technology together?
They did. The first communication satellites were done by Bell Labs. The first one was in 1960. It was called the Echo. It was a satellite balloon. It was kind of like this big, huge silver balloon, literally an orb. It was reflective, and they beamed a signal from the West Coast, and it bounced off this orbiting balloon and came down in New Jersey at Bell Labs. And a couple of years later, they did a more famous satellite called Telstar, which was an active satellite, and that could carry television and a lot more telephone transmissions. One thing I maybe should have said just before when I was answering your question about these solutions is that being part of a phone company, as Bell Labs was, they had this kind of never-ending stream of problems, and that's a pretty good spark, a good catalyst for finding good solutions. So as much as somehow the reputation of the place was as a kind of ivory tower of people thinking, you know, of deep science, on the other hand, they really were trying to solve practical problems, like how do you connect millions of people in a very effective, cost-effective, and speedy way? And out of these great challenges came a lot of these technologies I was just talking about, like transistors and lasers and communication satellites.
You know, that reminds me of a comment I read of yours. I don't remember whether it was in the book or in one of the reviews, but you said that the physicist Charles Townes observed that small town or farm America produced the Bell Lab innovators because it was such a perfect training ground. These are people who, in living on farms or in small communities, they were close up to the natural world, they could fix machinery, and they could solve problems. Now, I assume that's pretty anecdotal, but could you comment on just what role people like that did play in this great organization?
I think so. I mean, it is anecdotal, but I mean, it comes up again and again. And I think, you know, these were a lot of the men and later the women who came to Bell Labs came from small towns. I mean, a lot of them did go to, you know, what we might think of as famous or more prestigious graduate schools like MIT, for instance, or Harvard. But a lot of them grew up in very modest circumstances in small towns. Their fathers were small town lawyers or mechanics or fruit growers. And what I think Charles Townes, the inventor of the laser, was getting at was that, you know, he could not only understand the natural world and observe it firsthand, but a lot of these guys at Bell Labs really, you know, they could take a car engine apart and put it back together. So they had a kind of dexterity and a kind of everyday sort of interaction with the world. And as a sort of point of opinion, I wonder if some of that's in danger of no longer is the case. I think, you know, Townes was saying it was a great experience because we knew we were capable of solving these things with our own hands.
Sure.
And our own kind of intuition.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a different world now, and we work on computers, and we don't really necessarily understand what's going on deep inside
mm-hmm.
them.
You're listening to John Gertner. He's the author of The Idea Factory, Bell Labs and the Great Age of American Innovation. Well, as your subtitle suggests, what Bell Labs did is pioneer an innovation culture, and I guess you can't get too far into an understanding of that without knowing something about the role that Mervyn Kelly played, himself a small-town Missouri boy, as I remember.
Yeah, that's right. Mervyn Kelly was the president of Bell Labs during, I guess you could say, its golden era. And he rose really from a small town in Missouri, which I went to go visit. It was called Gallatin. Still is called Gallatin.
Where is Gallatin?
It's on the sort of western, northwestern part
of
Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful country. And it's a lovely place. His father ran a hardware store, and they really lived in very modest circumstances. And really, you know, a lot of the stories of the people of Bell Labs are kind of like Kelly's, again, coming from modest circumstances, finding they had a passion for science, and finding teachers who would encourage them along the way and sort of push them to that next step on the ladder, and eventually landing at this great laboratory where they could follow their passions and curiosities and, you know, work in a place where they could exchange ideas with other people with similar kinds of passions and really do things, I think, that they probably never imagined they would do in their lives. And it was quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the subtitle of the book, The Great Age of American Innovation, I think it's true that Bell Labs in some ways was, there's never been a place like it since, but I think I don't mean to necessarily suggest that it was the greatest thing that we've ever had, and we've never done great things since. I think it ushered in this era that, to some extent, we're still benefiting from, because a lot of these innovations, again, I use the word platform innovations, these are things that we've built our current electronics industry upon. And in that sense, it paved the way for really a remarkable era, I think, of prosperity in the United States.
Now, let's pick up on that for a moment. Sure, I can understand that Bell Labs is the pioneer, but that doesn't mean anything has come along better than that. But there is a couple of things that you mentioned in your book that I found fascinating. One, Kelly's development of interdisciplinary teams to work on these new technologies, and even the way the building was structured to encourage that. But also the fact that, again, since we're dealing with a monopoly here, not only was Bell Labs set up as a laboratory in New Jersey, but it also had facilities in the phone company's manufacturing plants. And I think one of the points you're making along the way here is, boy, try to do that in today's world when all the manufacturing, well, not all, but a lot of the manufacturing has gone offshore. Pretty tough to replicate that model today, is it not?
I think it is. And I think it's possible we'll regret that a little bit. The first point is a great point, interdisciplinary teams. It sounds almost obvious today, but it really wasn't at the time. And what Kelly was doing when he was the research director at Bell Labs and later president was he would organize these teams with, you know, people with complementary talents, and he was looking for not just like-minded people, but places where you could, you know, organizations of teams teams of people where you could create a kind of harmony as well as a tension between people with different sort of ways of looking at solving problems. And in many ways, this was a radical departure. He didn't want a group of physicists sitting together agreeing on a solution. He wanted a group of people with diverse opinions and diverse kinds of training working together to solve some of these problems. And well, he saw these problems as incredibly difficult and that they needed people of different talents to solve. As for that question of manufacturing, Kelly believed that the goal of Bell Labs was to bring an idea all the way through its process. And in fact, at Bell Labs, the word innovation had a special meaning. It wasn't just something that was new. It was an idea that was brought through the research process. It sometimes took many years in the development process, for instance, with an electronic device, making sure it was durable, reliable, it could be manufactured correctly. And then he set up teams at these actual manufacturing facilities to make sure that the technology was transferred appropriately and correctly to the manufacturing facility. And when I said, I wonder if we might regret not having more manufacturing facilities here, I think one concern is that, you know, when you're making stuff, you're always thinking about how to make it better. And there are these kinds of feedbacks that, you know, at least in the Bell Labs era, would sometimes, often at times rather, travel back to the laboratory itself. You know, they would understand what it took to make something, that just designing a new electronic device wasn't enough. You were always trying to design it in a way that was better, cheaper, which were two things that Kelly was always sort of concerned about. That was his mantra for innovation. Can it do a job better and cheaper? And manufacturing played a very big role in that.
Well, in spite of the emphasis on interdisciplinarity, these guys were individuals. Bill Shockley, John Bardeen, Walter Brattain, and I made me not pronouncing that name correctly. Tell us a little bit about these brilliant guys. They were eccentric and ego-driven, I suppose. But in the case of Shockley, he winds up being not the great team player that you'd think all this interdisciplinary would produce.
Yeah, I think it's true that as much as a lot of these inventions and ideas that I talk about in the book were collaborative efforts, you know, there's the human ego is a fragile thing. and some scientists there could control their urges better than others. Bill Shockley was instrumental in the research and invention of the transistor. And he just could not put aside his ego. And in fact, when two men under him, John Bardeen and Walter Brattain, as you said, came up with the very first transistor, it spurred Shockley out of envy to kind of improve on their design. And this was a no-no at Bell Labs. You were not, if you were a supervisor, supposed to compete with the people under you. You were supposed to sort of tease them, you know, tease their best impulses out and sort of push them on forward. But for Shockley, that was not something he could do. But, you know, in the book, one thing I wrestled with was how do you tell this great story about Bell Labs, because there were, at its peak, there were about 15,000 to 20,000 people working there. So a lot of what I focused on were some of these exemplary scientists and engineers who really just did remarkable work, and I tried to tell the story through them. Bill Shockley is one of them. Mervyn Kelly is another. Claude Shannon, a very eccentric mathematician who used to ride his unicycle up and down the hallways at night at Bell Labs, was another. And he really came up with some of these founding principles of digital communication that are still crucially important today. So it was a place that tolerated eccentricity, and in many ways, maybe that eccentricity translated sometimes into genius, too.
Exactly. Tell us about the role that silicon played in this development in those days.
Well, it's interesting in the sense that if you go back to the origins of the transistor, those early ones were made out of germanium, a different element, and the scientists at Bell Labs had trouble making it out of silicon. Now we talk about Silicon Valley and the age of silicon, and silicon is the crucial component in our chips and our processors. And all the transistors today are mostly made of, almost all made of silicon. But again, this was not the case at the very beginning. And it wasn't until about 5 years, 6 years after the transistor, that a team at Bell Labs started working on silicon. And they used special techniques to actually make this happen. The goal of having a silicon transistor is it would work at much hotter temperatures than a germanium transistor. So by Once the team at Bell Labs did finally fabricate a working silicon transistor that was also a manufacturable transistor, it was this moment of great excitement. And in some ways, that's the silicon age. This age of Silicon Valley really began not with the invention of the transistor in the late 1940s, but with the invention of a silicon transistor in the early 1950s. And one thing that also came out of that were silicon solar cells, which were also invented at Bell Labs and which really formed the basis for these solar panels we now see everywhere. They were sort of made with a very similar process to what was used for those first silicon transistors.
So when these three scientists shared the 1956 Nobel Prize in Physics, was it for the silicon transistor, or was it just for the entire body of their work over those years?
It was not for the silicon transistor. That was just really getting going. It was really for this breakthrough that they'd had, which were the germanium transistors. And you know, keep in mind, it's very hard to kind of go back and think about what the world looked like in 1956. There was no sense yet of what computers would do or how the transistor would eventually transform the world. I mean, some people knew. Some people knew it was big. Some people knew it would change things very drastically. But there wasn't a lot of proof yet. And there wasn't necessarily proof that the silicon transistor would change things much more drastically, say, than the germanium transistor. So what they were really being awarded was a kind of recognition that they had made a dramatic breakthrough that had changed the course of science and engineering. And I think the idea was certainly that it would pay off in ways undreamed at that particular point in time. But it was still up in the air as to what would finally happen. And the notion that we would all be walking around with smartphones was just unthinkable.
You're listening to John Gertner. He's the author of The Idea Factory, Bell Labs and the Great Age of American Innovation. Well, I assume that the leaders of Bell Labs may not even have figured out that they were entering the gateway to the future of microelectronics.
A few did, and a few didn't. I mean, unsurprisingly, a few of the people I wrote about, Mervyn Kelly, for instance, had this kind of gift for seeing farther and clearer in ways that are just surprising when you kind of look back on it. I remember going through his papers, and the same with Claude Shannon, this mathematician who would, you know, came up with a lot of the digital communications ideas, just that they could think so far ahead. And I'd be scratching my head looking through their letters of the time or their memos going, my goodness, in the early 1950s, they could kind of see that this would change things, you know, that it would usher in this era of microelectronics. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As brilliant as Bill Shockley was, latter part of his career didn't work out as great.
No, he took a wrong turn, both professionally and you could certainly say morally. And he spent really the latter 20 years of his life looking at connections and trying to prove a link between race and intelligence. And really, it's a tragic story. I mean, not only was Shockley just brilliant physicist, he was an incredibly gifted teacher of physics, many people attest to the fact that he was really one of the great college physics teachers of the 20th century. But once he embarked on this other side career, really in eugenics, he really became a disgraced figure and really an outcast amongst the scientific community, and understandably so.
Are we in as great a shape for the next age of American innovation as Bell Labs placed us in the great age? You talk in the conclusion of your book about some new projects. You refer to Genelia Farm. You refer to Secretary Chu's mention of innovation hubs. I wonder if you could address just where we are today as a country when it comes to the role of research and innovation, compared to where we were as Bell Labs was zipping through this incredible period in the 50s?
I think, for one thing, the world has changed. We live in a much more competitive world, and as much as we're still the greatest nation and the richest nation, there are many, many, many countries with wealth and certainly tremendous ambitions and great scholars and scholarships and a seriousness about creating their own futures, much the way maybe if we went back to the midpoint of the 20th century, Bell Labs and the United States was in a very similar way. So there's that. And then I think there's that question of You know, at Bell Labs, they didn't necessarily think of we need to find great ideas and great products. They were thinking more about problems. What are the big problems we have to solve? And I don't know. I worry about that a little bit. I don't know if we're investing in all the right places that we need to, especially for the economy of the future. We still put a lot of money, you know, $145 billion a year, I think, our government funds on research and development. A lot of that goes to military and medical research. But the question of whether we're creating these breakthroughs that will eventually turn into the industries of the future, I'm not so sure, especially I wonder about it in, say, energy or the like. So I think it's a hard thing to judge. There's certainly a lot of great work being done at universities around the country and at the national laboratories. But one great advantage of Bell Labs that we sort of lost was it did have a kind of way of staying with the development process, taking a breakthrough, nurturing it, keeping with it for 10 years or 20 years, and then finally bringing it to fruition through manufacturing. And that's a very expensive, painstaking process. And again, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the manufacturing now being offshored, for instance, and certainly I think the general public necessarily doesn't quite understand sometimes, and maybe understandably, how long it can take for an invention of certain magnitudes to pay off and how difficult it is really to bring it through a development and manufacturing process till it really makes an impact. So that's a sort of different kind of problem. That's more of an educational problem, perhaps, and trying to help us understand how vital some of this innovation funding really is.
Well, the focus on quarterly returns today is very different than back in those days. And, of course, you've already addressed this, but AT&T's status as a protected monopoly contributed to Bell Labs' success. I mean, you point out, I think, that Kelly gave his scientists so much time. Time was on their side. And I guess you've already said this, but it just doesn't seem like we're as patient and as willing to invest these days in the long-term developments that you had with Bell Labs.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think certainly the monopoly has its downsides, a lot of them. You know, consumers lack choice when there's a monopoly. Monopolies can slow the rate of innovation because they don't have competitors. But at least in this case, this laboratory, this weird historical circumstance by which the phone monopoly was able to create this immense laboratory that could really take, as you said, had the patience and the time and the stature so that people gave it the respect and I guess the autonomy to develop the kinds of devices that they saw were necessary. Really, that did change the world, and time was an important factor in that, not just money, but time.
So we've extolled the virtues of Bell Labs now for almost a half an hour. There's time for one question left, and I'm going to ask you about the picture phone. They didn't do everything right. We Skype today, but they couldn't figure out the picture phone, or I guess the customers didn't figure out the picture phone.
That's right. It's absolutely true that innovators make mistakes all the time, and Bell Labs, just like any other very innovative organization, made a big mistake with the picture phone. And let's not forget that Apple makes mistakes, and they had the Newton, and they had all sorts of other things that didn't catch on. So the picture phone was way too expensive, and it was way too far ahead of its time. And it was before the internet. So really, if I wanted to talk to someone who had a picture phone, they had to have their own picture phone. You couldn't just certainly open your laptop and talk to someone through Skype. And I think it goes to the notion that being early is not necessarily different from being wrong for an innovator.
The name of the book, The Idea Factory, Bell Labs in the Great Age of American Innovation. The author is John Gertner. John, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thanks very much, Bob.
Next week, Jim Rassenberger, author of The Brilliant Disaster, JFK, Castro, and America's Doomed Invasion of Cuba's Bay of Pigs. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.